Just to get started, I wanted to go over the most recent round of Board of Game meetings. A lot of big issues came up this time around, and some big changes, especially around here in South Central and on the Kenai Peninsula. And I guess I'll just kind of open it up to you as you sat through that testimony, heard all that testimony, and talk a little bit about some of those issues.
Okay. Well, first off, thank you very much for inviting me. It's always enjoyable to talk about board activities and fishing game and the process. We have the most public process in the country, and I'm really proud of that and really enjoy being a part of it to begin with. We had three board meetings during the last cycle. We had one in Southeast that dealt with just issues in units 1 through 5, which probably doesn't influence our local hunters that much or trappers. But if you're interested in any of those decisions, that was a Petersburg meeting, give me a call. My number's in the book, and I'll be glad to run over some of the results of that Southeast meeting for you. We also had a meeting in Anchorage. That meeting was held in March, and we dealt with South Central issues, which is, of course, our area, and Kodiak and southern part of the Anchorage area. Cordova is all in the South Central, plus Unit 7 and 15, our areas. A lot of really important issues that were brought up there. And then we also dealt with a joint board meeting. Now, the joint Board of Fish and Board of Game meet about once every 4 or 5 years. So we were on schedule for a joint board meeting. We held one of those. And we dealt primarily with advisory committees. We made a few changes, nothing substantial. There's no really big issues that I don't think that people are going to be concerned about. One of the issues that came up, the commercial fishermen were really concerned about this in the joint meeting, and that was a proposal to change the advisory committees having jurisdiction for the Cook Inlet Resurrection Bay area by removing Mount Yenlo and Denali advisory committees. There was a lot of public testimony about that one, and on both sides. Some felt that they were so far away from Cook Inlet, they shouldn't have that strong of a voice in Cook Inlet. And of course, others felt that because, you know, they use this resource in Cook Inlet, they need to have their voice. Anyway, both the Board of Game and the Board of Fish both unanimously voted that one down. So Mount Yenlo and Denali advisory committees will still be involved. If you want to go into the South Central, there were quite a few issues that we dealt with on the South Central. I'll just hit some of the highlights. We did make a change in the Kenai Mountains caribou hunt. That season's going to be shorter now. It's going to be the same as the Kili River, right? August 10 to September 20.
Kind of line those two seasons up?
Yes, sir. Those are going to be aligned. There's still going to be permits issued for that, about 25 tags. We did make a couple changes to increase goat hunting opportunities way down south near Port Graham, Nanwalek, and so forth. There were a couple additions to those, so that was beneficial to locals. But the big issue was moose. Mm-hmm. We got into the moose discussions and spent the big part of a day working on moose. Fish and Game presented a lot of information as far as the health of our moose population. The southern part, 15C, looks like it's fairly healthy, around 3,200, maybe 3,500 moose in that area. The other thing that was really made aware of, is because of the selective harvest that we've implemented over the last 4 or 5 years, 6 years maybe now, with the spike in 50 and 4 brout times, mm-hmm. that has really changed the dynamics of the bull-cow ratio on the Kenai. And what I mean by that is it's gone from, you know, low numbers, around 9, 10 or so bulls to the 100 cows. Now we're up to about 40 to 50 bulls for every 100 cows. And I know as a local hunter, personally, I see a lot of bulls. Sometimes I'll see more bulls than cows. Of course, they're all sub-legal bulls. They're not a legal bull, right. But I see a lot of bulls. And hunters are saying the same thing. They're seeing a lot of these mid-sized bulls. At any rate, we discussed this, and it was an exhaustive process we went through. Tremendous amount of public testimony on this one in support. And what the board came up with is a new hunting strategy for this fall. We still have selective harvest, but now we have spike 50 or greater, or three brow tines. So now the four brow tines has been replaced for, you can take a moose with three brow tines, and that's on at least one side, not both sides. And that will be in place this fall on your regular moose harvest ticket.
And what's the anticipated effect that these changes will have in terms of take rates for hunters and that sort of thing?
Well, I'm hoping to fill my freezer, that's for sure. It's going to make a huge difference. You know, one thing about the Kenai, we don't produce moose with high numbers of brow tines like you see in the interior. And there's a lot of argument and discussion and debate back and forth on why that happens. You know, the one of the theories is moose that feed primarily on willow produce more brow tines. Moose like we have here feed primarily on birch and aspen, produce fewer brow tines. And like I said, it's a good argument. I have no support one way or the other on that one, but I hear that one all the time. It may be true, it may not.
Yeah.
But we don't produce a lot of brow tines like they do in the interior. So this will help a lot.
Well, and I wanted to get into some of the other factors that have driven some of these changes, because, you know, before we started recording, we were talking about, you know, recent fires have changed the habitat picture. And there are some other things that have gone into this that have given fish and game managers a chance to kind of reevaluate these numbers and look at some of these changes and come up with some of these different ideas, and that's led to some of these policy changes. And the fires have been the big one, right?
Well,
or one the, of?
One of. The history of moose on the Kenai was literally written with the 1947 and 1969 burns.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to also think about the predation situation during those years. You know, we really didn't have any wolves on the Kenai until the early 70s. I mean, there was a wolf seen in 61. There was a pack on Tustamine in 68. By the early 70s, they started to build up. By the late 70s, they were pretty much spread across the Kenai. They recolonized the Kenai in a hurry. And I hear the argument all the time about Fish and Game planted the wolves, or Fish and Wildlife Service planted the wolves. There's absolutely no truth in that. Those wolves moved onto the Kenai from northern stocks. You know, when I worked for Fish and Game, we collared a lot of wolves. During the early 80s, when we were dealing with this lice thing, we captured about 150 wolves. And we put radio collars on a good share of them, and several of them moved off the Kenai. So we saw movement go off the Kenai, and there were no studies around Anchorage. We didn't see any come back on. It's reasonable to understand that wolves recolonized naturally, because they were gone from the Kenai starting about 1915. And that was because of poisoning and unregulated hunting and trapping year-round. Mm-hmm. A lot of miners here, and they actually killed the wolves off, lots of them,
yeah.
And a lot of bears. So the kind of the upshot of all of that is now that we have fairly well-established wolf numbers, I don't know exactly what they are, but it's probably a little bit lower than it was when I worked for Fish and Game. We thought there was maybe 180 to 200 on the Kenai. It may be 140 or 50 or something now, because our moose numbers are lower. But the fires have made a big difference as far as, you know, healthier habitats for moose. The problem is we still have a lot of bears and a lot of wolves. And although the habitat is going to result in higher twinning rates and maybe more calves being born, you still have to get through that predation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why our moose population really hasn't grown. I think the predator-prey ratio is still fairly high on the Kenai.
Now, when you say the kind of the history of moose is traced back to these major fire events, I mean, maybe for myself, definitely included, but for folks who aren't super familiar with the moose hunting world, what, there's kind of an ebb and flow to that, and one sort of mirrors the other. And why is that? It's a clearing of habitat, to be sure, but are there other things in play there?
Well, the one thing that you have to think about when you're managing moose is moose are early serial stage of habitat, you know, animal. In other words, if you have a fire or some sort of a event that clears land in some way, so you have regrowth, in a couple years, you know, you start seeing willow and aspen and birch coming back in good numbers, and then it lasts for moose for about 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then after 25 years, that regrowth is so tall, it grows out of reach, and moose, you know, struggle trying to stay healthy.
Kind of levels off.
It levels off. And at the same time, you know, you have to understand where the predation rates come in. And as we were talking early, you know, calves are born in a fairly high rate. On if you have healthy habitat, healthy moose population, you could have 100, maybe 110, maybe even 130 in really healthy habitats, calves born for every 100 cows out there. So at that rate, that's what you can count in the spring. And then in the fall, in November, when you count moose, some of those calf-cow ratios are down to 10, 15, 20. The Russian River, for example, I remember one year counting that, it was 5 calves to the 100 cows. And, of course, there's so many bears on the Russian River, it's easy to understand.
Sure.
And then there's been some really interesting studies done on predation rates on the Kenai, Glen Allen area, Fairbanks, McGrath. There's probably half a dozen good studies around the state. And back in the early 70s, most of us, including myself, thought wolves were the predator on moose calves. And we went into a study in the mid-70s in Glen Allen thinking that. And it didn't take us long to realize that all of the moose calves that we had captured as newborns and collared, they were being killed by bears. I mean, it turned the way of thinking as far as predation. And it all happened in 5 or 6 weeks. And some of those studies show that bears were killing, you know, 50-60% of the calves that were being born that we had collared, which is probably indicative of what happens in the real world. Mm-hmm. I know that Fish and Game collared a couple large male brown bears in Unit 13, and they put a GoPro camera in the collar. And I don't have the exact numbers, but each bear killed about 50 animals, each individual bear, like 35 moose and 15 caribou calves or something. But you just think about that. Over our population on the Kenai, it's not hard to understand with the bear population and density we have of bears and a fairly high number of wolves that moose have a hard time making a living.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's not necessarily the newborn calves either that are potentially most subject to that predation. That's something that that's kind of interesting.
Well, you know, what we also found in some of these studies is that if a pack of wolves is raising pups, it's more, you know, of an advantage to them to kill an adult moose because a newborn calf moose is 35 pounds or so at birth. That doesn't feed a whole bunch of hungry pups. Whereas, especially yearlings, you know, yearlings are kicked out in the spring. Moose have a calf every year. A lot of people think it's every other year, but it's, if they're healthy, it's every year. And those yearlings are kicked out. They're absolutely lost. They're wandering around out there thinking, why did my mother run me off? And they fall prey to predators, primarily wolves. But, it's a real interesting dynamic. And it varies from area to area. But on the Kenai, our moose populations in the northern part are the ones that are really low.
Right.
And that's primarily habitat.
And that's been sort of the situation for some time, right? That's been sort of the trend of things for a while?
It has.
Yeah.
Yeah. Down in the southern part in 15C, the Caribou Hills and so forth, you know, in the last decade or so, there's been a little over 100,000 acres burned. So there's some tremendous regrowth and, you know, good habitat down there. So
yeah.
Makes a big difference.
Makes a big difference, to be sure. You know, you're and talking about going back to some of these studies, I'm really curious about how, especially from both your viewpoint as someone who worked in Fish and Game, and then also from your perch on the Board of Game, how was our general, or I guess, how was our base of knowledge changed over the years? You've been studying some of these things for going on 40 years, and I'm sure that the body of knowledge now that informs these decisions is tremendously bigger than it was, you know, three decades ago.
It's huge.
Yeah.
There's no question. And here's an interesting thing. Back during the Knowles administration, there was an issue that came up in McGrath on wolves, too many wolves. People locally couldn't get a moose. So anyway, he contracted with the National Academy of Science to look at predator control and how it would work. And they did. And they've came up with a study, spent $300,000 and so forth in a year or so to complete it. And what they said was, you know, it can work if everything's done right and you harvest enough wolves. You can't just take a few here and there. You have to be, you know, pretty clinical as far as removing wolves. What I wish we would do is repeat that study. And the reason for it is we did that during a time when there was very little thorough predator control work done. If we would look at it today, and we look at some of the changes that were made in Unit 13, that went from about 400 moose harvested a year to now it's about 1,200 harvested a year. The good, close example for us is across the inlet in 16B. We started predator control there in 2004. Moose numbers were fairly low. Now moose numbers are so high, they're actually about 2,500 moose over the population goal. The goal is 65 to 7,500 moose. The last count in 16B, 10,000 moose. And the board just opened up more opportunities there to hunt. And those results are so clear now because it takes a long-term predator control study. You can't just do it 1 year. You have to be thorough and do it properly. The other thing is the wolves are now back in 16B. A lot more food for the moose or wolves, mm-hmm. I mean.
Yeah, as one population goes up, so follows
it.
Sure.
So it's not like we've decimated wolves and they'll never come back. Wolves are now in a healthier position than they were, you know, 20 years ago. So, yeah, there's some good science. It's pretty straightforward. And, yeah, there's a world of difference in new knowledge that we're dealing with today.
We're talking a lot about moose, but there's and moose and wolves, and touched a little bit on bears. Bears are a part of this equation as well. And what were some changes the board made in terms of managing bears this year? Or were there many major changes?
Well, there were a couple. There was nothing here locally. Our seasons are black bears and brown mm-hmm. bears, and so all still the same. The major change was we had a lot of public testimony from Anchorage folks that they're having lots of bear problems.
Yeah, when we talk about that sort of wild-urban interface, and you do, it's that's, I mean, just sort of anecdotally, you see it in the paper, on the news, yeah.
Yeah, there was quite a bit of testimony and written testimony and oral testimony, people actually coming there and talking with board members. We did two things. We opened up two very small draw hunts. They'll be up to 20 permits. Shotgun, muzzleloader only, you know, no high-powered rifles on McHugh Creek, and the other is the Campbell Creek area mm-hmm. in the Anchorage management area. We opened up two of those. We're still kind of working with the state parks folks to sort out how that's going to happen, but we tried to recognize the interest in reducing the bear numbers. But I'll be very straightforward with you. That hunt is not going to reduce bear numbers at some level to make it really, really safe for people to hike trails.
Right.
People need to take the responsibility of being bear-aware in Alaska. And it's not just Anchorage, it's out your back door. That's the bottom line. But the board did go that far to open up a couple hunts, although small and limited in area. So we tried to do a little bit to help there, but I have very little confidence it's going to make a huge change in safety.
Well, there's, you know, Anchorage sits sort of famously, you know, just right on the edge of Alaska is where you'll find Anchorage.
Close to Alaska.
It's pretty close to Alaska. But that's, you know, joking aside, that's, you know, it is. It's right there on the edge. It's in the wilderness, as so much of Alaska is basically in a raw wilderness, and the nature's still getting used to us being here a little bit in some of these places, and so there's only so much management that can be done to a degree.
Yeah. Yeah, it's whenever you're dealing with wildlife in big cities, and we see it all around the country, whether it's elk or white-tailed deer or mule deer or whatever that, you know, have found a good home and easy food and no predators generally, you know, right in town. Of course, that also brings predators into town, you know, like mountain lions and coyotes showing up all mm-hmm. over San Francisco and whatever.
And yeah.
So, I mean, there's a lot of dynamics that go with these changes in wildlife numbers, especially in these urban areas. But, you know, hopefully Alaskans are pretty reasonable when it comes to safety, and certainly there's a lot of people that support hunting. There's a fair number of people that don't support hunting. But when it comes to safety, and especially your children and stuff like that, there's good support for the board and the Department of Fish and Game to do things. And I'm glad to see that the department has killed some of these bears that have caused problems. You know, we can't tolerate a dangerous nuisance bear in town. And
and there are, we know, one thing about bears that we know is how mobile they are.
Oh, yeah.
And so good faith efforts to relocate a bear don't necessarily do much good, because they're like so many other creatures, they'll just go right back to where they came from. And that could be hundreds of miles.
Yeah. It could be really quick.
And very quick, too, yeah. Yes.
You know, when I worked for Fish and Game, this was probably during the 80s here, we had a real low harvest quota, 14 bears. So what we did is, you know, we were trying to move bears out rather than, you know, me shooting the bears, although we did shoot a fair number of them that were really dangerous bears. But I moved a fair number of bears out of this local area right here, and my success rate was about 50%. Usually they beat me back to town. So, but it was three strikes and you're out. If I moved them twice, the third time, we dispatched the bear.
They do become habituated quite quickly.
Easily, yes.
Yeah. I wanted to talk, too, a little bit about, you know, sort of in broad terms, we're talking sort of generally about moose and their predators. I wanted to talk a little bit about caribou, too, because, as you mentioned, there's some changes there with a couple of caribou hunts trying to bring things in line here on the Kenai Peninsula. Maybe you could talk sort of generally about how those different populations are doing and what those hunts are like.
Well, we have four introduced caribou populations on the Kenai. They all came from the Nelchina Basin out of Glen Allen. The first two came in the 65 and 66. Those gave rise to the Kenai Mountains herd, which is two or 300 animals now. That's the one that we just readjusted the season down. And then we have the Kenai Lowlands caribou herd, which is by the airport. These are the ones we see by the Warren Ames Bridge,
right,
and so forth. I saw two last night driving down the highway by Fred Myers, two mm-hmm. bulls. But that's the lowland herd. That one is about 100 or so animals. It's been hunted a couple times, but it's fairly low, so it's not hunted now.
Right. Yeah, that's the herd that I think people are maybe most familiar with, or at least I'm most familiar with, and it's sort of famously not a particularly highly populated herd. And so, yeah, that's what led my question, just sort of generally, what is caribou hunting like here? Because I know that there's not a ton of it, not as much as there is moose hunting.
Yeah. Well, then there's two other herds, the Killy River.
Yeah.
Those were brought here in the mid-80s. And again, those were from Glen Allen. There's the Killy River Herd and the Fox River Herd. And the Fox River Herd is south of Tustamina Glacier. It's really small. In fact, some years they don't count very many animals. Some years they'll count, you know, 50, 60, 80 animals, and then they kind of disappear. I'm not sure that they don't cross over and join the Killy River, which is 300 and something. At one time, I counted, this was in about 2002, I counted 710 caribou in that herd, and it had grown beyond carrying capacity. And then that was the same year, then in the spring, when they had a big avalanche. And I personally counted 143 dead caribou in that avalanche, and I didn't count them all.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we lost a lot of caribou to avalanches. And then there was another big avalanche that same year, and there were about 25 or at least in that avalanche. And then they moved. They kind of went to a new habitat trying to find, you know, a place to make a living.
Right.
But so that herd kind of went through that standard reintroduction, you know, huge increase and then decline. And now they're kind of stabilized at about 300 or so animals, and they issue 25 permits there each year. The Kenai lowlands, let's go back to that one, because that's really an interesting one. That's a lot of us see those.
Right.
I see them in my yard, you know, south of town. I see them in my yard during the summertime. That herd has the potential to be about 1,500 caribou if you look at the amount of available habitat for them. The problem with that herd is calf survival. They produce a fair number of calves every year, and by fall, there's very few of those calves left. And we collared a few of those calves, about 10 of them. Safari Club International gave us some money and paid for the study. And what we found out is that some were killed on the road. We had some that were killed by coyotes. We had some killed by marathon road by dogs. We had one of them killed by a lynx. So there's a variety of things that kill these calves, but domestic dogs were the biggest predator on the lowland caribou herd, and it probably still is. People dump their dogs out, or they just leave from town and run out there with these caribou, and the caribou live right around town. That's the unfortunate
They're pretty close.
Part. Yeah.
Well, I guess I that just sort of surprises me, because I you know, I can only judge from my own experience with my dog, but I know that when we come across a large ungulate out in the wild, she's knows quite well that she's overmatched and not too interested in that sort of thing.
Well, you have a smart dog.
Sometimes smarter than for her own good, but I'm just surprised by that. That seems doesn't seem implausible, certainly not, but it's just something I wouldn't have never thought of, that the domestic dogs are an influence on a population of large animals like that.
Yeah. Well, they don't impact the adults.
Right,
they catch
the
calves.
It all starts at the beginning of the life cycle.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they just, you know, like I said, they produce a fair number of calves, and by fall, those calves are pretty much gone, because these caribou live right around town, and that's a real... you know, dangerous place to live if there's free-ranging domestic dogs.
Is that a goal, sort of policy-wise, to take more advantage of that available habitat and get that lowland herd those numbers up a little bit?
Well, there's not much we can do other than maybe move more caribou here. And there was I wrote up a grant proposal years ago when they removed all the naval. Folks from ADAC. There's a pretty large caribou population there, and they were going to reduce that population. And those came from the Nelchina back in about 1956 to benefit the Navy and so forth. So anyway, we were going to get 150 caribou from ADAC and have them moved and released on the lowland herd to get that one kind of over the edge, you know, and get moving. And it all fell apart. We never did move any of those caribou, and that was kind of our one big hope to really help this herd. But the main thing is, if people would really take more interest in watching their dogs, if you live close to the Marathon Road or, you know, here in Kenai, any place where these caribou are found, you can't blame a dog. If you see a caribou calf running, you just have to chase it.
Yeah, that's pretty intrinsic in a dog.
It is, yeah. If it runs, you have to go after it. So
that's right.
You know, there's some other issues that came up on the South Central board meeting that I think are really important. One is that we've had since 1977 a limited draw hunt in 15B East. This is between Skelak and Tustamina for moose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it started out with 40 tags, and then it got bumped to 100 tags, and there's been some changes made there over time, but since about 82, it's remained about the same. And what has happened there is that moose population, probably because the forest has been maturing, has declined to a level where hunters in the past would kill 25 to 35 bulls. I remember in the early 80s, the average bull in 15B East, because we had hunters bring them all in to measure, and we collected lower jaw to age, so we had age and size. The average bull was 58-inch bull. Now, it's hard for hunters to find a moose up there.
Right.
So what the board did, and there were three proposals. There was one from the Central Peninsula, which is Nanilchik. That's the one we adopted. There was one from Fishing Game, and there was one from our local advisory committee, Kenai Soldotna. And we adopted the one from the Nanilchik, and we did away with the draw hunt. Now, that's not going to happen this year. Because we've already issued permits, people that have drawn permits for 15B East Moose Area will hunt there under their permit. So next fall, 2020, then you, me, everybody else can hunt that under a regular harvest ticket, and it'll be the same antler bag limit, spike 50, 3 brow ties. And that'll help happen next fall. Not this fall, the following fall.
Next fall, and that'll really open things up.
It'll really help. And the other thing is, it's a hard area to get into. And if people have horses, then they never draw the permits. And people that don't have horses draw the permits. So that's one of the issues. So now if you have a horse or horses, whatever, and you hunt with them, you'll now be able to hunt 15B East on a harvest ticket. So I thought that was a good move. People always say you never, once you go to a drawing permit, you never go away from it. And that's usually true. But we finally, in one case here, we did go back. Here's another interesting one that the board passed. The department came up with a proposal to issue some any bull tags. And their proposal was just for 15C, which is the Caribou Hills. There was another proposal from the Kenai Soldotna Advisory Committee to issue these any bull tags in Unit 7 and all of 50. That's the one the board passed. The language speaks to up to 200 permits. Now, Fish and Game is not going to issue all 200, but we always make it high, so if they want more, they don't have to come back to the board and readjust. So up to 200 permits. There was some real strong testimony and encouragement for the board to issue a handful of permits in Unit 7 and 15A and 15B, and then the majority, probably 25 to 30, something like that, in 15C. And again, this is to address this high bull-cow ratio. And if you draw one of those tags, I think you'll have a pretty good chance to get a, I mean, I could kill one in my yard every year because there's always an illegal moose or sublegal moose in my yard during the season. So if I drew one of those tags. The other thing, and the reason why that the board was really encouraging Fishing Game to issue permits in all these areas is to reduce the odds a little bit. Because if they only have it in one area, with Anchorage being so close, you can only imagine the difficulty in drawing one of these permits.
Right.
So it'll help our odds a little bit if they spread them out. Maybe 5 permits in A, 5 in B, 5 in 7, and 25 or so in C, something like that.
Well, and that's how you divvy up permits and what kind of permits. You could do a whole series of programs about all those different issues, and maybe we'll save that one for another time.
And if your odds of drawing something like mine, you don't have to worry anyway. I just send them a check every year, write donation on the bottom.
That's right.
Turn it in. But those were, you know, those were the primary issues we dealt with on the Kenai. We approved the Calgon, any moose hunt out there. Calgon's going to be all the same. We didn't change any of the antler restrictions there. We authorized a cow hunt in Homer, the Homer cow hunt that's been in place now for, I don't know, 25 years or so, 35 tags. We reauthorized that cow hunt. So those are all the same. And that, you know, that, again, that's kind of the primary
The big ticket items.
Big ticket items for us as far as local moose hunters.
You know, I wanted to, while I have you here, and considering that you're rounding out your last term on the board, wondered if you could just maybe, if we could just step back and talk a little bit about that time on the board and sort of how that time was informed by your time in the field as a working fish and game guy, as a biologist and doing that sort of thing. And you know, what are some of the things that you're happy to have been a part of on the board over these years?
How much time do you have?
Much as you want.
Well, first off, you know, I worked for Fish and Game for a little over 28 years, 24 years here, the rest in Glen Allen. It was a real honor to work for the department, and it's certainly an honor to work for the Board of Game. You know, when I retired, I never thought anything about working for the Board of Game. I didn't put my name in. It was put in by a couple advisory committees that I'd worked with for years and years. So I got a call from Governor Murkowski, and he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm hanging sheetrock." He said, I need you to go to work for me. And I said, and that kind of makes the guy pause for a minute. And I said, "Well, yes, sir. What'd you have in mind?" He said, "Well, I want you on the Board of Game." I said, "Well, that'd be an honor. I'll be glad to do that." "Yeah, yes, thank you." And so anyway, I don't know if you recall, but Governor Murkowski took 5 of Governor Knowles' appointees off the board at one shot.
Yeah.
Not sure that was legal, but he did it. And probably it was somewhat legal. But anyway, he restructured the Board of Game, and he put 5 people on that were certainly good, I would say, conservationist, people that understood management and how things actually worked and didn't have any agendas to, you know, either, you know, protect all the wolves or protect all the bears. We were looking at management of wildlife, you know, and the science.
Right.
So I was put on the board in 02. And like I said, I've been really fortunate to be in there during a time when we had governors. And it probably started with Murkowski and certainly with Palin and Purnell, that they understood that if we were going to manage wildlife in Alaska, we were going to have to do it a little differently. We couldn't just be passive. We had to get involved in active management. And then in 1994, that's when the intensive management law came into play, and that opened the door on intensive management. But it wasn't until about 03, 04, especially 04, that we really got involved in predator control and intensive management, both with bears and wolves. I mean, we've removed bears in areas and made a real difference on, and again, going back to what we talked about early on calf mortality, you can remove all the wolves in the country, but still, if you have lots of bears, you never get that pulse going through so that those calves are large enough and old enough that they're producing calves.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to understand all the different things that affect a moose population. It's a broad equation. It's not a one-point deal. It might be weather, might be habitat, you know, it might be predators, it may be disease,
and
I
mean, really it's them all. Some combination thereof. It's a whole system, and each part of it's tied to the other part of it,
and it always is. You know, a lot of people like to just pinpoint one thing. Well, it's only habitat, it's only predation. Other than weather events, that's the only time it's one thing that really made a some sort of population collapse is a weather event. If you have 4 feet of snow in November and it persists, which we've seen on the Kenai.
Sure.
In the early 70s, we had 3 winters in a row that were just back to back to back. No moose calves survived. Lots of adults died. And we had a lot of really deep winters, deep snow winters in the late 70s. And our moose population was probably about 15,000 moose on the Kenai. So we had an overpopulation of moose. They had already destroyed a lot of their habitat because of over browsing. And then along comes 3 horrible winters. What a recipe for a disaster. And that moose population went from about 15,000 to about 8,000 or 9,000 in just a matter of a few years. Now it's probably around 6,000 or so on the Kenai.
Yeah. And all of this under the auspices of trying to manage not just the wildlife, but manage people. That's always a big, we're managing people too.
Right. Wildlife are easy.
But all of this under the auspices of trying to manage for sustainable yields. You know, that's, you throw all those variables together and there's a, there's a lot of room for things to happen.
Yeah. You know, it's in our state constitution that we're going to manage for, you know, sustainability. And, you know, for the benefit of people, all people. And we also benefit the non-residents. I mean, we have to give credit to the non-residents. They pay about 72% of the costs for fish and game management in our state. And I know being on the board, we have a lot of people that say, you know, we need to get rid of non-residents. And they take about 3% of the overall harvest. They take a very, very small, and they pay 72% of the bill. So unless we want to start paying, you know, hundreds of dollars for our hunting license and trapping license, those non-residents, they pay more than their share, and they take very few animals.
That gets glossed over, and whether you're talking about hunting here locally on the Kenai Peninsula or big game hunts in some far-flung corner of the world, those hunters that travel there to do that specifically are the ones who are paying for the ongoing costs of management and putting in place new policies and whatever else goes along with making sure that those populations stay there as long as they can.
They do. I mean, hunters pay the bill all the way across the board. And but anyway, you know, just get back to the career question you asked.
Yes.
Until I wandered off in another direction. again, it has been such an honor to work for the department and work for the board and different, you know, five governors, I guess now. But it's the big change, I guess, has been the science. We have come such a long ways. And the public participation in a regular board meeting that's in Anchorage or Fairbanks, whatever, you know, we'll have over 100 people testify. We'll be in public testimony for 2 or 3 days. And I can't think of a state that has a system like we have where any individual can put a proposal in and it goes to the board. It's not like we sort them out or sort through them. If you write a proposal, we read it, it becomes part of the process, and we'll deliberate on your proposal. You don't have to be an advisory committee or a fishing game. Any group, any individual can submit something. They come to the board and testify. Written comments, you know, when we have really hot issues like one at McNeil River 1 year, we had over 5,000 written comments. And the board members are required to read all public information and comments prior to making a decision. So you can think there was some long nights of reading, reading comments when you get that many. So a lot of public interest. And the one thing that I think I'll remember about being on the board is all the friends and people I've met across the state. I've had an opportunity to go to a lot of different places, being on the board, and I've just met a lot of wonderful people, good conservationists. You know, I've met a lot of people that just hate hunting, but they've been very respectful, and I have some very good friends that really don't like hunting at all. And I understand that, and I'm very respectful of that, They know that I'm a hunter. They know that I like to put a moose in my freezer when I can get one, and our family takes a moose when we can, and fish and caribou and whatever we can get. We like the Alaska way of life. My wife took a nice black bear a couple days ago, and we processed all the meat, and it's now in our freezer. We're going to get some sausage made of that black bear, and, you know, that's something we enjoy doing here in Alaska. And, you know, people that don't hunt, I think most of them do respect that a lot of us do, and we like this Alaska way of life, and we like this organic food that we have at our doorsteps.
That's right. Well, and you brought up your wife, Elena, is also very involved with the hunting, and maybe if you wanted to take a couple minutes and talk about the Women on Target program.
Yeah, absolutely. We had our first class. Elena's the clinic director for Women on Target, and that is sponsored by NRA. It's also sponsored by Safari Club International, and we work with the Snowshoe Gun Club. I mean, we have to have some place, and the Snowshoe Gun Club has been gracious enough to let us, you know, have our classes there. We had our first class a few days ago. We had women there, introductory to shotgun, shooting trap. And I can tell you, I was really amazed. Most of them had never shot a shotgun. And by the time the class was over, they were breaking clays. And it wasn't because of my expert, you know, or Elena's expert instruction. Just good skill levels. They really did well. I was impressed. And they had a good time. We have two more classes on handguns coming up fairly soon. I think one of them's filled. The other one is probably close to being filled in June. And then we have one for rifles later on in August. But... We've had this going now for about 10 years, maybe close to 10 years. We're up to over 800 women. We also have teens on target. This is for high school age girls. And usually we have about 8 or 10. Starts in November and we run through most of the winter. They go through all the disciplines as well, handgun, shotgun, rifle. We have local police come in and teach them self-defense so they can, because that usually results in them going home and beating up their brother. But that has been really rewarding. We've had several of these young ladies that started out with us really early and have been in the teens on target for 3 or 4 years and become excellent shooters and very safe and careful with firearms. These programs, as far as the emphasis of the program, it's firearm safety. It's not hunting. We're not teaching you to be a hunter. If you want to be a hunter, that's good.
You'll learn that on your own time.
Yeah, we want you to be safe, and it's because every home in Alaska pretty much has a firearm, and especially when you have children. You have to be very careful because they're curious. We teach a lot about home safety and so forth and what to do and not to do. We also teach a lot about being bear aware. A lot of the ladies take this course because they hike and they camp and so forth, and they're just nervous about bears.
Or you're just walking around the neighborhood. I mean, there are a lot of neighborhoods where, in my neighborhood, it's a pretty good idea to take at least a can of bear spray with you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we talk about bear spray. We talk about handguns. We talk about things to do or not to do around bears. And the best part about this is we have a target that we pull towards you with a four-wheeler as fast as we can pull it. And it's a big silhouette of a charging bear.
Uh-huh.
And you have to stand in place and shoot this bear as it comes toward. The women, they're so intimidated the first time. But then after that, they can't get enough of it. They like shoot the bear again. But it's those sort of things that we try to teach people. And we also teach them, and this is probably one of the more important points, is firearm handling is a perishable skill.
Yes.
You can't just go to this class for one day. It's $35. It's very inexpensive. We provide all the ammunition, the rifles, the guns, shotguns, pistols, all of it. So you just basically show up. Because an NRA grant, an SCI grant, allows us to do this. But you can't just come there one day, at the end of the day, say, I hit the target every time, I did really well, and then never pick it up again.
Mm-hmm.
You have to practice all the time to be efficient. And if you're not get a can of pepper spray.
That's right.
But anyway, yeah, I appreciate you letting me talk about Women on Target, Teens on Target. I hope people look at our Facebook and get signed up if they're interested, and we'll see you out there in the range.
That's right. Well, you know, we're coming up almost an hour already. It's just flown by. Yeah, can you believe it? I wanted to ask, make sure I squeeze this in before we let you go. Parting wisdom for an incoming president of the Board of Game.
Listen to the people. That's probably the only thing. You know, as chairman, that's one thing I've always tried to do, because I learned that from past, you know, chairmen of the board. Listen to the people. Listen to people and look at the science, and just brush aside all the emotion. You know, we have a lot of that. People come to the board and, you know, they're either passionate about saving animals, they're passionate about hunting, they're passionate about trapping. There's a middle road in everything that we do, and that's where you have to look at the science and listen to the people. And I guess that's what I've learned.
Yeah. People run the process.
They do.
Yeah.
It's their resource, not mine.
Very good. Ted Spraker, thank you so much for taking some time and joining us, and maybe we can do this again sometime. You've got a schedule full of Saturdays now.
Hey, every day is a Saturday for retired guys, so thank you again for having me. Like I said, I really enjoy talking about wildlife. It's always been a big part of my life and a real passion for me, so anytime. Be glad to do it.
Great. Thanks again.